This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Secondly, it's the state's proper function actively to promote social justice among the citizens and societies through body politics. Sometimes when the basic structures of society, quote, are not up to the mark with regard to justice, end of quote, the state may itself have to step in and provide benefits of one sort and another. But that is malformation. In general, it is the proper function of the state actively to promote the satisfaction of the right to education without providing education itself. Thirdly, Martin holds that in the area of economics, it is the state's proper function to engage in whatever activities are necessary to secure economic welfare. Of course, even in the domain of economics, Martin wishes to protect his principle of pluralism. He argues that normally it is good policy for the state to promote and support the efforts of business and labor institutions rather than itself to perform the economic functions necessary to the public welfare. Still, he does not hold that the state is necessarily malformed if, for example, it nationalizes certain industries or provides a guaranteed annual income. In the domain of economic welfare, but only in this domain, it is within the state's proper function to act as a service organization. State can operate as a service organization in the realm of economic welfare. Okay? Let me distinguish between two things. Martin says the state ought to promote education, but except in exceptional circumstances, the state ought not to provide education. Okay? With respect to education, the state stimulates others to educate, but it does not educate itself. If all is going well. However, in economic matters, that cautious reserve, that being at arm's distance, is not there. Martin says, in economic matters, the state can provide the economic welfare. It doesn't simply stimulate charitable organizations to do so. The state can directly dole out the welfare. Do you see the difference? Well, there's any good to go on if you don't. Anybody not see the difference? In education, the state promotes social justice, quote-unquote, by stimulating others to provide education. In economic welfare, the state directly provides the welfare, and that's fine. Okay? Now, if I go up and down the street, knocking on doors and suggesting to people, it'd be a good idea if you educated your children, I'd be stimulating education. But if I go up and down, knocking on doors, handing out $20 bills, I'm supplying economic welfare. I'm not just saying, you ought to go somewhere where you can get $20 bills. I'm saying, here they are. Okay, so that in the crassest way possible, I think, draws the distinction. The main question that must be put to this view of legal regulation and welfare is this. Why should the service function of the state be limited to economic welfare? Isn't that a purely arbitrary limitation? What is it that is fundamentally different between the sphere of economics and, say, that of art? What is it that is fundamentally different? I know there's a difference between economics and art, but what in principle is so different? To this question, Martin has no answer. The attempt to give a theoretical safeguard against the totalitarian state proves, at least in Martin's version of the law, justice, and welfare view, to have no structural basis. And this, I think, is characteristic. Those who hold such a view, as I've got up here on the board, as legal regulation and welfare, those who hold this view characteristically have no principle to offer in objection to the state's becoming a service institution in other domains than the economic. Why shouldn't the state tell us what the proper art ought to be in our society? Why shouldn't the state supply our education? Why shouldn't the state rule our families? I mean, if it can dole out service in matters of economic welfare, Why shouldn't it just take over the rest of life? Montaigne has no principled answer. And thereby, those who follow this view have no principle to offer an objection to the state's becoming totalitarian, I don't think. Now, the chief task for anyone attracted to this view that I've been describing would be to find just such a principle, to keep the state, having now broken into the realm of economic welfare, from breaking into other realms as well. Now, of course, in our own day and age, you can see that that's just not a theoretical paper question, is it? Because the state today is not confining itself to economic welfare. The state is now making efforts to say what can happen in our families. The state is now telling us, in even Christian schools, what can happen in the realm of education. You see, once you give the state the right to go beyond its law, regulation, powers, and domain, one has to ask, when does the monster stop growing? Now, in strong contrast to the view that I've just been looking at, legal regulation and welfare as the proper function of the state, we have what I call the law and order view, or if you will, just legal regulation. Okay? Montaigne says legal regulation and welfare. Now I'm going to look at a view that simply says the state's proper function is legal regulation, pure and simple. This, of course, is the most constricted of contemporary Christian views as to the domain of the state's proper function. And it has been found mainly among Anabaptists, Anglo-Saxon evangelicals, and traditional Reformed theologians. Of course, those three traditions in various ways will differ sharply from each other on related but distinct issues, such as to whether Christians may actively participate in the coercive, non-voluntary institution, which is the state. But I don't have time to treat that right now. I mean, there are differences among these groups, but nevertheless, they all are basically holding to the view that the state is engaged in legal regulation.
Anglo-Saxon, evangelical,
traditional Reformed, Calvinistic. The reason I say Anglo-Saxon evangelicals, I am trusting everybody understands, that the word evangelical in German simply means the Lutheran Church. And consequently, you've got to make it clear when you speak of the evangelical wing, we mean Anglo-Saxon evangelicalism. Broadly, you know, the evangelical churches today, those that hold to the fundamental doctrines of the Christian faith, and the need for blood atonement, and so forth. The Anabaptist-Calvinist controversy is a traditional one in church history, stemming from divergent views as to whether the state is a good or evil order by its very nature. And we will be looking at the Anabaptist-Calvinist controversy, and Lord willing, tomorrow evening. But for now, I'm going to suppress those differences and simply look at what is held in common. And to give, again, specificity to the general view I'm expounding, I'm going to be considering Carl F. H. Henry's book, Aspects of Christian Social Ethics, because that the second view is the one toward which Henry consistently gravitates. We've looked at Jacques Maritain, the Roman Catholic. We'll now look at Carl Henry, the American Baptist.
What's the date of Henry's book, roughly?
See if I have it written down.
Rather recent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Compared to the Christian personal ethics. That's an old one.
It is, I think, the mid-60s. I think the personal ethics was before that, 57, that was published. For some reason, I don't have it in my notes here, but it wouldn't be hard to find it. Okay, Carl Henry's view. Again, simply as one representative of this general idea that the state's limited to legal regulation. A theme which pervades Henry's thought is that of abhorrence for the totalitarian tendency of contemporary states. He remarks that, quote, when the power of the state becomes the means for compelling people to do their whole duty, this power can easily be employed to force people to do what is not their duty at all, end of quote. In his discussion, Henry singles out especially two connected causes for the self-aggrandizement of contemporary states. First, the belief that the state should act out of benevolence toward the desires of its citizens. Those who believe the state ought to act benevolently are out of benevolence toward the desires of its citizens, that is, satisfying the wants of its citizens. And secondly, the belief that the state can and should be an instrument of social transformation and renewal. that the state should take it upon itself to bring about changes in values, social transformation. Okay. There are two connected causes for the reason the state is becoming totalitarian in our day. One, the view that it should act out of benevolence toward the desires of its citizens. So if the citizens want something, the state should benevolently supply it. And two, that the state should be an instrument of social transformation and renewal. If you want an example, forced busing. We will force people to change their attitudes towards race relations by having mandatory integration.
Did Henry advocate that?
No, he does not.
Oh.
Does not. He's not, well, he certainly advocates integration, as I do, and better race relations. But the view here is that the state should be the agent of transforming our values, that the state should be the one who's trying to change our outlook.
Well, that's what I thought you said.
He's saying that that is the problem, that the state thinks that it should be doing that.
Oh, okay.
Okay. He sees these beliefs as the principal culprit behind the encroaching welfare state, which is, quote, no longer dedicated to justice and order, encouraging and enforcing human rights and responsibilities under God, but is benevolently bent toward people's socioeconomic wants, end quote. Now, Henry is himself deeply convinced that our society needs renewal. I mean, I don't want you to misunderstand. Equally, he is convinced that Christians must work for such renewal. But, he argues, that such renewal will come about if and only if there is a religious change in the hearts of individual men. Evangelism and not legislation is the road to social betterment. And so he says, quote, the reliance on political means to lift all the burdens of mankind is characteristic of contemporary social theory, in which secular concerns wholly replace the spiritual. Such secular proposals, while claiming to promote social justice, tend in the long run simply to readjust the existing disorders along new lines. In a word, the state tries to remedy one economic woe, and in so doing simply creates another economic woe. The, quote, aim of the Christian's political activity, he goes on to say, is not to produce a utopia, but to preserve justice and promote order in a fallen world. And so he asks rhetorically, is not the state's obligation in preserving justice to provide what is due, that is corresponding to the rights of men, rather than to implement agape by acts of mercy or love? Is the state's job to promote agape? Or is the state's job simply to preserve justice, provide what is due? Can the state force people to love? No, but the state can force people to be just. That is, the state can regulate our relationship to our neighbor, even if we hate him in our heart of hearts. However, the state cannot change the attitude of my heart. Now, from what I've said, these quotations, it's clear how Henry views the proper function of the state, isn't it? The state's proper function is to maintain a system of laws regulating the activities of the members of society, a system of laws which secure good order and protect the rights of the members of the body politic. As he puts it, quote, the justification of civil law is that it protects my rights and my neighbors. The role of government is but to declare, to apply, and to enforce rights which are given of God and therefore inalienable. The purpose of law is to prevent one person from injuring another. My rights end and become my duty where my neighbor's rights begin, end of quote. The same point could be put in terms of justice rather than in terms of rights. The laws must be based on principles of good order and justice, for justice considers every person a subject of rights and an object of duties, Stanley says. Now, in reflection, this point of view will quite inevitably stimulate the following kind of question. It always does, I notice. People are going to start asking questions once you say these sorts of things. Do not the members of our society have a right to education, a right to fire protection, a right to decent medical care, a right to enough income to live decently if disabled? And so, will not a system of laws based on justice secure these rights to the citizenry? Why then should the securing of these rights be prejudicially described as the benevolent satisfaction of want? We're criticizing Henry now. But if the state does actually secure these rights, will it not then become what Henry so abhors, a service state distributing benefits? In short, does not Henry's own principle of justice lead to a vastly more comprehensive state than he wants? No doubt some thinkers have justified a comprehensive service state, a welfare state, by the principle of benevolence. But does Henry's own principle of justice lead to the same destination by a different road? That is, does Henry end up in the same camp with Maritain when all is said and done? What's the answer to that question? No. Okay? Get that in your notes. No. The reason for that's going to be a very important one. You may not agree with Henry, you may not agree with Maritain, but seeing the difference between them is crucial. I do not know whether Henry holds that in our well-to-do society, citizens have a right to education. But it is clear that even if he does, he does not believe that it is the state's business to provide education. For this is not the kind of right he is speaking of. And I'm going to distinguish two different kinds of rights here this evening. When Henry speaks of rights, he is speaking of what I will call freedom rights. The right to act without coercion in one area or another. A freedom right is the right to act without coercion in one area or another. The right to act without coercion. Examples of freedom rights. The right of free assembly. It is the right to assemble without coercive restraint. The right to free speech, the right to speak your mind without being coerced. The right to private property, that is the right to do what you want with your own rather than being coerced, so forth. But when men speak of the right to education, they do not mean the absence of coercive threats against getting an education. You understand that the right to free speech is different than the right to education. They do not mean the right freely to pursue an education if one so chooses. Those who speak of education as a right mean rather the right to receive an education. And that's completely different. That's what I call a benefit right. Okay, we have freedom rights and benefit rights to be distinguished in. Freedom rights call for protection. I will be protected as I speak my mind. That is the right to free speech. Benefit rights, on the other hand, call for provision. The right to education means that I have a right to have it provided. The state should provide an education for me. Similarly, the right of the disabled to a decent income is not the right freely to go about securing an income. Again, we speak of the rights of the disabled to a decent income. We're not talking about a freedom right. They are free to go about trying to get their money. We're talking about a benefit right. They have the right to have the state supply such an income to them. A freedom right is a claim on everyone to respect that right. A benefit right is a claim on someone or other to satisfy that right. Okay, here we respect somebody's right and protect it. It's a claim to be protected. I should be protected in my free speech. You should respect my right to speak my mind. Whereas in a benefit right, that is a right to have it provided for me. It is a right to have this need satisfied by somebody else. Not simply respected, but satisfied. Now, does that rather clearly delineate these two different things? Okay, let's go over it again. A freedom right is a right in the sense that it lays the duty on somebody else to protect and respect what I'm doing. Okay, my freedom right of free speech means that you have the duty to let me speak my mind. It doesn't mean you have to provide a speech for me. Okay, whereas the benefit right of education is not that simply you have the freedom to go about getting whatever education you want. The benefit right of education means the state has the duty to provide an education for me, to pay for my schooling. Okay, so one is a hands-off kind of right, and the other is an open hand kind of right. That is, it's a providing kind of right. One, you keep at a distance. You say, I've got the freedom to do this, and the other means you have the duty to provide something for me. And I think a good deal of discussion among evangelical Christians about rights today is complicated by a confusion between these two senses of the word right. In fact, when you read my book on homosexuality, there's even a third sense that you'll come across, what I call the non-discrimination right. Okay, and so that's even a third category of right. And then there's these confusions that come about and are not distinguishing matters, and so we argue at cross purposes. I think it virtually certain that when Carl Henry speaks of right, that it's freedom rights and not benefit rights that he has in mind. Correspondingly, when he speaks of justice as consisting in establishing a man's right by securing what is due to him, he has freedom rights and not benefit rights in mind. It is not social justice, but regulative justice that he is thinking of. Henry's view is that the state's proper function is to regulate the activities of its citizens by maintaining a system of laws based on regulative justice and good order. It is not the state's proper function actively to promote social justice, actively to promote the satisfaction of benefit rights. And certainly it's not its proper function itself to dispense services in any area whatsoever. This Henry takes to be the biblical view on the matter. The Bible, he says, views government as a means of preserving justice in a fallen and sinful order. I have a good deal more in my notes here on Henry, but I'm going to skip for the sake of time. How might somebody argue against Henry's view? Let's pursue this a moment. Somebody might say that we should chiefly be given pause before this law and order view of the state by its radical exclusion of social justice from the domain of the state's proper function. That is, the exclusion of benefit rights. Doesn't that look just a little bit suspect, somebody might say? It's impossible to read the Old Testament prophets without seeing that it was social justice they were calling for. It was the deprivation of benefit rights that evoked their denunciations. The Christian cannot possibly regard justice as confined to law and order, to legal regulation, if you read the Old Testament. What do the Old Testament prophets say? Say the widows and the poor, the orphans are being neglected, that the Sabbaths are not being honored, servants aren't being given their rest, and all the other requirements. So can you read the Old Testament prophets and agree with Carl Henry here? Well, it's one thing, of course, to say this, to say that the Old Testament prophets call for the care of the poor, and quite another thing to say that the Old Testament prophets thought of it as the proper function of the state to provide for the poor. And it's lamentable, I think, that so many Christians do not even distinguish between those two questions. Now, Christians may differ with my own conviction on that matter, but I think it's hard to talk to people that don't even know the difference between those two views. The Old Testament prophets call for a concern for the poor, and I think it is to our shame, it's indeed our culpable sin before God, that we are not taking care of the poor today. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. But that, my friends, is a completely different question from whether the state's proper function is to care for the poor. Now, of course, you could say by way of rebuttal, but who else will do it if the state doesn't do it? Well, God's people might be called upon to freely do so. The church might be called upon. Charitable organizations might be called upon. There are other options, after all. In fact, it is symptomatic of 20th century thought to immediately wonder, well, who else could do it if the state doesn't do it? Because in our own conception and mentality, the state has become a messianic order. You know, all the things the Messiah does, he does through the state, or so it is implicitly thought.
What I was going to allude to, like I say here, the Old Testament, there was no, the state
and the religion are two sides of one coin. So who is actually providing, who is supposed to provide for widows and so forth? It wouldn't have mattered because state and Judaism were one, two sides of the same coin.
Are you suggesting that the church and the state were not separate institutions in the Old Testament? They were united in the Old Testament? Is that what I hear you saying?
Well, that's my understanding.
Okay. As we go through this course, I'm going to challenge that assumption. I'm going to suggest that people did know the difference between the state and the non-state in the Old Testament. They did know the difference between the king's palace and the temple of God. They knew the difference between the coffers of the king and the temple treasury. They knew the difference between a king and a priest. They knew the difference between Aaron and Moses. They knew the difference between laws regulating the cult and laws regulating society. And so there are some senses in which the church and the state have to be spoken of as distinct in the Old Testament. But even if you don't hold to that, you can at least see that the Old Testament prophets could be calling upon individuals to be taking care of the poor in their localities rather than upon the state to tax people to take care of the poor. So even if there was a merger of church and state in the Old Testament, there still was individuals over against the collective right or power of the state. And all I'm saying here is whatever your attitude may be toward the answer to that question, but that is a different question. To say that we have to take care of the poor is not to say that the state has to take care of the poor. There may be one way and there may be others. Okay, but having said that, what reason can Henry offer for not moving to the conclusion that the state should provide for the poor? How can Henry defend his view? Well, Henry's defense is that social justice can be secured only if hearts are changed, and conversely, that it will be secured if hearts are changed. Now, it can be argued that that's just false, though. It's true that in a society of sanctified men, social justice will flow forth. So too will regulative justice. And we must indeed beware of the utopian heresy that the kingdom of God will be inaugurated by the state and its coercive devices. But what concerns us here is not the society of sanctified men, but our mixed society. And it is argued against Henry, it's simply not true that benefit rights cannot be secured in such a society. Now what's the difficulty? Is Henry arguing that benefit rights cannot be provided in a mixed society by the state? Or is he rather saying that benefit rights should not be supplied by the state in our mixed society? Of course, it's the latter. We must see that this line of attack on Henry is misconceiving his position.
Just as our last sentiment, please.
Okay, the point is that the critic says, Henry, you're just wrong to say that a mixed society, through the agency of the state, cannot supply benefit rights. Cannot supply. That is, you're just wrong to say that until hearts are changed, we can't supply education for people. We can. Of course, Henry's point is, oh yeah, we can, but we shouldn't. And that which we are supplying is not genuine.
Maybe Henry also believes we cannot, too. He is saying should not. In fairness to him, right?
Yeah.
But possibly he also believes we cannot.
Cannot, in the full qualitative sense, supply what ought to be supplied. We can't change men's hearts by education. Okay. I could be saying more about it, but I think it would serve our purposes to go on to the next one again.
Then I understand his point that that we can't force men's hearts to change, but what would be a solution? Something like integrating school, if we weren't to do it by a law, if the state wasn't to pass a law to force that.
You know the answer to that question. That's so obvious that you're missing it because it's so close to you.
Okay, why don't you help me?
Well, aren't we sitting in a building owned by an institution that is fostering the very sort of thing that Henry's giving
up?
Isn't the gospel a way of changing men's hearts? Isn't preaching God's will for racial relations and our need to repent of our racial sins and so forth a more effective and true way of doing this work rather than passing a law that just makes our outer actions appear to conform to that? Henry would say we should be preaching the gospel to bring about racial reconciliation, not passing laws about it.
Segregation.
Well, he may. I don't know the precise answer that Henry would give to your question. Okay, I'm doing my best to take what I see and follow it out and give an answer. But it certainly seems to me that Henry could answer that equal education is not a right in the first place. That is an ideal. Mm-hmm. That would be very loving, and that would be wonderful to attain, and we'll do our best to do it.
Okay.
But that it's a right? I mean, how can it be right? How can it be a duty to see to it that everybody has the same amount of money? I mean, why isn't it that the differences between people as to their ability, as to their hard work, as to their experience and all the rest,
mm-hmm.
is that they should not be differentiated in terms of what they have put into their lives? I mean, it may very well be that people don't have a right to an equal amount of money. And if they don't have a right to an equal amount of money, you can hardly say they have a right to an equal amount of benefit for their children. I mean, rich children go to Disney World a lot more than poor children do. And rich children go to better schools than poor children. But as a matter of fact, it's the parents' duty to provide education, and poor parents cannot say they have a right to provide the same kind of education as rich parents.
No, they have, that may be so, but they have the right to at least seek that opportunity for an equal education. I wouldn't say that.
Now, you're talking about
freedom of education just wrenched away from them and have no opportunity either.
Wait a minute. Who wrenches this education away from them?
I guess the way that.
So you're talking as though somebody stands in the schoolroom door, even though the poor child, you know, can pay for the education.
Did stand in front of the schoolroom door, so.
That wasn't for the sake of the quality of the education.
No, it was for the sake of keep black people from getting an education in Alabama University.
No, yeah, in Alabama University,
right.
But not from getting an education.
But
now, I have to think that his attitude is reprehensible, okay? I'm going to begin there. But in defense of the historical veracity of this, you must remember that Wallace did not believe that Negroes could not get an education. He believed they should not be educated
in the
same. Only one of us can communicate at one time. I'll finish one sentence, and you'll get a sentence, and then I'll get a sentence, and we'll do it fairly. He did not believe that they should be educated in the same room, in the same school. He believed there should be black schools and white schools. I don't happen to hold to that view. But he wasn't saying that education should be wrenched from them. He was saying they should not be educated here. Okay. Now, Carl F. H. Henry and George Wallace are miles apart. Okay. So now bringing him into the picture, to be fair to Henry, we've just got to get that out. Henry can say that it is not a benefit right, equal education, although it is a freedom right. Anybody who can pursue an education has the right to do so. We should not prevent them from doing, you know, what they are able to do. But that we have to provide it's another question. He would rather say, I believe, that equal education is a wonderful ideal toward which we as Christians should be working, so that if my next door neighbor is not able to provide the kind of education I can provide for my children, perhaps I can financially underwrite part of the education of his child as a way of, one, loving my neighbor, seeing to the future betterment of his child, and thereby improving my society as a whole. Now, I can see that as Henry's answer, and thereby not taking away any of the Christian compassion and agape and charity and all the rest. All he's saying is the state doesn't have to be the one who does it.
Okay, so you're saying that just because of a black person, I've been forced to have to go to a school that's obviously totally inferior, and then not be allowed to go to a certain white school that might be better. You're saying that that's not depriving him of his right to seek an education. He can go to the obviously inferior school.
Wait a minute. You're portraying my view. Now, we're talking about Carl F. H. Henry's view, that is the extension of this law, legal regulation view, by the way, we keep shifting between racial and financial categories, which I think is terribly unfair and pigeonholes people. But let's say either because of discrimination against poor children or discrimination against children of another racial category, that if you have a white school, let's say, that does not allow black children to be educated there, that black children are being deprived of an education that is equally as good as that in the white school. Isn't that to assume an awful lot? For instance, if the black school can't be as good as the white school? That, by the way, to my way of thinking, is much more demeaning than is the very practice of segregation. There is nothing to assume that black schools cannot be as good as white schools, unless you think black people are inferior.
I didn't say that.
I know you didn't say that. What I'm suggesting is that when we start thinking about the implications of our attitudes and the implications of the way we argue, there may be things in the whole package of our beliefs that are not coherent. Okay? So I may hold two different views, and as I pursue this one, lo and behold, it runs into this one. Now, we started with Henry saying that education is not a benefit right. It's a freedom right. Okay. Somebody says, look, these children need a good education too. And Henry says, I agree. Let's take care of it in a charitable way rather than by the state coercively taxing people and supplying itself. All I'm saying is that that's one option open to a Christian, to hold the view that the state doesn't have to be the one who provides benefits. Okay, now over again, so that we get this really clear now, I want to go one step at a time with you. What is it you find objectionable in that? That he should say, maybe the state doesn't have to be the agency providing these benefits. Maybe the church can. Why can't the church open a school that's integrated and that, as a matter of fact, gives a financial break to poor families? I mean, Henry could certainly poll to all the ideals that I think you're striving for, but still I hold that the state has to be the one who does it. Now, in the end, the Bible may say the state should be the one who does it. I'm not prejudicing the end of the question. I'm just trying to lay out the ball field and trying to delineate what the various teams are right now. Okay? No.
Okay.
I don't want to give up on this until you're satisfied.
I'd rather have you go on when we think about it.
Oh, okay.
Really
need to do that. Back here.
I think maybe I would agree with that. The point you made about him and then the other one. I think the brother of trying to get into something out there.
Go ahead. We all want to get it out.
I wonder if we can superimpose another language on your language about freedom rights and benefit rights and use another something I think more conventional, like inequality of opportunity over and against the equality of results. Although that terminology out of Christopher Jenks, if you want to, it's researchable. This is not some fantasy kind of thing.
No, that's okay. Equality of opportunity?
I don't know if we can do that. Maybe that confuses the issue more. But I think that would get more to what the brother, I think that would, if you would critique Henry in the context of dealing with the difference between equality of opportunity and equality of results, and I think you get more to what the brother's concern is. I think that's what the brother's concern is.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. But that's it.
Why don't you pursue it that way? The objection being that we should provide equal opportunity for poor or poor children or children of another race. All right? We should provide equal opportunity. And, I mean, is that the point of view over against Henry's that we're thinking about? I'm just trying to get straight in my own mind. I'm not setting you up. I don't know what I'll say if that is what you're saying. I'm just saying is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. Now, what would Carl F. H. Henry say?
Well, it's hard playing
the freedom rights and benefit rights. I'm saying maybe we can superimpose the idea of the quality of opportunity and then over against the equality of results.
Yeah, I don't have any difficulty changing the vocabulary. I think that we're getting at the same thing. When you say equal opportunity, I think you're talking about providing a benefit to somebody. You're saying that you should have the right to the same kind of education as anybody else.
Okay, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, if there's some slippage there, of course, it'll make a difference in how we go back and forth.
But when you get to the equality of results, where would you see that stand out?
Well, okay, when you speak of equality of results, you're not speaking of the right to equal results, are you? I mean, I don't know of any writer who says that we have a right to equal results.
Right, okay.
I mean, let me give you an example. Some child comes in from a rich family, okay? And what does he do at school? Well, I mean, he should spit once and get sent out of the room and spends a lot of time at recess and sitting in the principal's office. And as a matter of fact, he makes a vocation of doing this and actually goes through 12 years of schooling and has spent probably 80% of his time out of the classroom. Okay,
Now we take a poor child who comes to school and realizes that if he's ever going to do better than his parents, that he's going to have to learn something here, he's going to have to apply himself, and he doesn't become valedictorian of his class, you know, his high school graduation class. Now somebody says, wait a minute, that's not right. Both of these children have a right to equal results. Do they have a right to equal results? Well, in that sense, it's obvious to all of us, nobody has a right to equal results. You only have a right to pursue what you can possibly get out of the education. I mean, am I making sense?
Yeah, right.
Okay, so what could the right to equal results mean other than that? Probably the right to equal results would have to be a right to the opportunity to gain the same results as somebody else if you applied yourself, you know, mutatis mutandis, okay? If all other things are changed appropriately, then it turns out that this child A and this child B should have the same result. Well, as a matter of fact, I agree with that. I agree that if the same work is done, the same honor ought to be given. Okay, and the same accomplishment ought not to be differentiated according to race or financial standard. However, I don't see that as necessarily a question of political theory. It may be a problem in our schools that there's prejudice, okay? And the heart of man has to be changed toward that, and fairness has to be promoted and all that. But I think Henry would probably call that a freedom right. I should have the freedom to be valedictorian just as this person would if I do work, you know, as he would or better than him. Okay? And if somebody makes some lackey valedictorian, I'm the one who's gotten straight A's. That, you see, is depriving me of my freedom to pursue this. That's a coercive intrusion in the competitive realm of education or something. So, now all this is very valuable. I mean, whether we stand on the same side of these issues, and of course, in all of this, I haven't given my own convictions. I've been trying to stay within the ballpark of Henry's convictions. But the reason we're doing this is you begin to see how complicated discussion among Christians becomes of right when we all are using different conceptions. Now, in your terminology, equality of result, equality of opportunity here, freedom right, benefit right, we have to understand the concepts and how they're different if we're going to be communicating with each other clearly. Go ahead.
I have a great deal of difficulty comprehending how spending more money on busing is going to improve an education.
Okay.
I mean, everybody's complaining about the quality of education going down as it is, and people are, you know, feeling like, you know, this is pretty heavy taxing already. And then to go pile more on to move kids around and jumble them around when by a school within the same school district should have the same thing as a school over in another place in another district, the same quality of teachers and the same kind of equipment. I have difficulty comprehending why they don't have an equal education anyhow. But, you know, that's
well,
just me.
I don't have any doubt but that if you look at a ghetto public school and a public school in a wealthy area, say, Palisades, in Southern California,
I'm sure that maybe the parent-teachers or organization in that school provides a little extra, maybe. I
think it probably is a lot more than the parent-teacher association that makes the difference. I think there's an awful lot that is wrong about the educational setup as you go from, you know, a poor district to a rich district and all that. But what I want to say in relationship to some of our discussion here, and especially this, that in all honesty, the modern polemic for busing has nothing to do with quality of education. It has to do with social value.
With changing your social values.
That's right.
Your family has to want you, right? Your social values have to be changed.
That's
so
right.
My kids over there have to get to learn to like me and vice versa.
That's right. And the thought is that if we get children of different races to be educated together and spend time together, that they will have a better attitude, they'll have a more harmonious relationship than by teaching them.
It's all social behavior, which is a Pavlovian sort of thing.
Well, maybe so. But my point simply here with respect to busing is that the benefit right of education doesn't have anything to do with busing. Okay? We've introduced a lot of different topics here, and I just want to get them straightened out. I know we're out of time, but there's one more hand, and I want to honor that before we leave.
Well, I think one of the problems is we mostly
Hillary community didn't realize what public education is. It's social education and not education.
It's not an intellectual education.
That's right. It's not education as we presume it is. It's social education.
Right. Uh-huh. Okay. Now, that is one of the opinions available to y'all. I happen to think it's a very good one, but please remember that this discussion tonight is trying to delineate which teams are on the ball field, okay? And there is a team that says the government should bring law and order and economic welfare. There's another team that says law and order is the proper function, but economic welfare, other institutions should do. Tomorrow night, which we should have been doing earlier tonight, we're going to talk about the rest. I'm very excited about getting into these issues. As you can see, this course is going to be dealing with a few things of relevance and maybe touching some vital nerves as well. So please come back tomorrow night and we'll pick it up again.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.